Coming up on this episode of Inside Pop,
we are reacting to the most recent episode of Game of Thrones and also the mid-season finale of Queen Sugar.
Plus, we're discussing the controversy surrounding the new film Detroit and sharing feedback from our discussion last week about South Asian TV and film relationships.
All of that, and of course, the big sell right now on Inside Pop.
Hello, I'm Amita Patel.
And I'm Sean David Johnson, and this is Inside Pop, your weekly dive inside the world of pop culture. This week, we are recapping two of our absolutely favorite shows on television. We're going to get to the Queen Sugar mid-season finale in a few moments, but first, let us cross the narrow sea in about 2 seconds and discuss Game of Thrones.
I feel like every time we want to discuss it, I have to sing the theme song. Okay, guys, we're going to talk about Game of Thrones. So it's really hard to not have spoilers. So we're giving a huge, huge spoiler alert. We, you know, drop our episode on Wednesday. You should have hopefully seen it by now. And if you haven't, skip ahead 10 minutes. We're talking about all of it. All right. So, I mean, so much is happening. We have Stark reunions. We had an epic dragon battle. It was such a good episode. Like, each one of the episodes have been this season. I will say my first reaction, I think like last week, I think I started to feel it. And this week I felt it a lot. We're moving super, super fast. And we started to move fast. And I think I made this comment last season too. But now it's just even faster, I feel.
The travel. Yes. Because in the books, it was ridiculous. Somebody would travel from King's Landing to Winterfell, and it would take 4 months. But now, oh, yeah, I'm going to cross the narrow sea. And sometimes it's not even the next episode. It's the next act. It's the next scene. They're there. And I'm like, they are definitely not taking the MTA because that is that's my hack joke for the episode. But yeah, it's all lightning speed. And right, I remember last year I said, I love it. It's so much faster than the previous seasons. It's making sense. Mm-hmm. I still enjoy the fast pace. I will say that there is a little feeling of it being rushed. You know, because I think you and I have talked so much about the fact that they only have X number of episodes left now. So when I think about the writer's room and the index cards they have up on their wall and all the plot that they have to get through, I do see, you know, that index card where a writer has written, John on the boat on his way to see Daenerys, and that card gets taken off the board. We don't have time for that. Let's just have him walking onto the beach, right? Like, so I'm feeling that.
Right. Is it the best idea? It's just one of those things where they made this huge announcement that they're going to only do, you know, I don't know, what is it, 13, 14 episodes between two seasons in the next 2 years. So, but if that was the case and you saw this happening, like, why didn't you just do a couple more episodes each season to have a little bit more story development?
Yeah, I think I'm sure that money is playing a part. I'm sure, you know, actor contracts, etc., all of that stuff plays a part as well. But I will say that I'm still preferring this speed as opposed to seasons 1, 2, and 3, 4. I'm still enjoying the rapid nature of the way the plot is unfolding and the characters are moving.
Good segue to the next thing I wanted to discuss. I think the slower ones of the first few seasons, agree, were really slow. I think last season, as much as I fought it at the beginning, was a decent pace. Because towards the end, I was like, this is great. So I still think they kind of turned it up a notch this season from last season. So I would prefer last season's pace. Aside from that, though, because it's moving so fast and every other scene, someone is finally reuniting with someone else, like Arya and Sansa and Arya and Bran. And then Jon Snow and Theon. And they stared at each other for so long. It was a perfect amount of time, I felt, because I was sitting there like, are they friends right now? Are they not? Are they going to kill each other? I'm so confused because it's been so long. We've had 6 seasons worth, and I'm forgetting some of the beefs and the relationships for some of these characters who are just like reuniting over and like fast pace in every episode. Do you feel that way?
I think that the characters I care about and the characters I'm more invested in, I have better memories of their plot lines. So, for example, I care a lot about Jon Snow on a few different levels. And as soon as I saw them on the beach, I actually did yell out, oh, shit, which because, you know, they grew up together. So I remembered the whole thing. You know, they grew up together as brothers-ish, right? Remember, he was part of the house. He was part of the Stark household. But then he betrayed the Starks. And then he was accused, took credit for and owned killing the two brothers, which, of course, wasn't the case. But I don't think he knew that. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. I think that in that case, it all clicked. And I realized that they have bad blood, as that woman with the blonde hair would sing. Not Daenerys, Taylor Swift.
That woman with the blonde hair. Okay.
Yes. They've got bad blood.
They do. No, they do. And thank you for retracing that history for me, because once you started to say it, I kind of remembered those pieces. But it was just, sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it can be very hard to remember these characters' relationships.
Yeah, I think if Game of Thrones had been developed for television and not based on books, that would never have happened. But if it had been, then there would not have been so many characters. There would not have been so many plot lines to keep track of. But because it's based on these books, and initially they tried to be loyal to the books, sometimes possibly to a fault, you do need to have a PowerPoint presentation next to you as you watch. And HBO does give that to you. If you want to, you can watch on your iPad as the episode's going on, and you can see maps, interactive maps of Westeros, and kind of figure out everyone is. And they have house biographies, and you can remind yourself, okay, right, he's part of that house, and that house is at war, or that house holds the banner for the other house. So they do help you. They admit that it's complicated, but
I'm gonna do that next time. I think I need it, especially this season when things move so fast. I think I'll need it. Or I'm just going to reach out to my cousin. Shout out Alicia. She is seriously a Game of Thrones encyclopedia. We were going on a family trip this past weekend, and we were all talking about Game of Thrones in the car, and she was just like, well, yeah, but this one was that, and this one was that, and she knew every single character, their full name, and how they were all, like, related to each other. It was amazing. So she's also on speed dial if I ever have any questions.
That's good. Yes, phone a friend while watching Game of Thrones. So
one last question about the episode. Did any of the reunions make you shed a single tear? Shawn Johnson, Arya and Sansa reunion, Arya and Bronn reunion.
You know how I like to shed a single tear.
I know.
I will say that I have been talking on this podcast for quite a while about how I could not wait for the Stark reunion, and how I was probably the Stark reunion that gave me the most anxiety, but also the greatest anticipation, is the reunion between Arya and Sansa, because they did not like each other as children. They did not get along. They were very different. And I was just hoping and needing for them to come together. And it's interesting. It was exactly, I think, as it should have been. They didn't run to each other in slow motion. But you know what? There was an immediate trust. There was an immediate, without saying too much, we're there for each other. We will tell our stories of horror and pain and survival later, but I will smile at you. We're both grown up now. I think it's not what I thought I wanted and expected, but it was exactly, I think, the right way to reunite those two. So it didn't feel as emotional for me as just satisfying. Yep, they're back, and no time for emotion. Who am I? I'm trying to, like, walk into Winterfell and bring this emotional reunion. Sean, dry your tears, put on your armor, and get ready for winter, because it's here.
Exactly. That's it. That's all it was. I completely agree. It was, I think they did it really, really well. They had a great reunion as sisters, and I think, you know, you said that they kind of saw each other, and I feel like there was a great instant sense of respect as well, because I think each of them had at least heard a little bit of what the other had gone through, through ravens and other things. So they kind of knew they've been through a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And,
you know, yeah, and I like that. And I like that moment when Arya says she's glad that she's in charge, that Sansa's in charge.
Right. 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 Even that moment where she said, "Shall I call you Lady Stark?" And Sansa says, "Yes." It's just like, matter of fact. I mean, that is their relationship. And also, yeah, no time for BS. Right. And I think both of them know that in their very different ways. So formidable partnership. And then I think,
for sure.
Yeah. And then I think with Bran, I think we've realized, yeah, Bran is gone. That was made very clear to us in this episode. Mm-hmm. And there's zero emotion there. But I think he's going, of course, going to be pivotal and very important. And I think it all comes down to these Stark kids. I'm someone who cares about the Starks more than the dragons. I really am all about the Starks.
I'm all about the Starks for sure. Dragons come, like, as a second. Like, Daenerys and the dragons are, like, second on my list of, like, things I care about in Game of Thrones. And this is the perfect segue to that epic dragon battle. Do you think that Jaime Lannister is dead?
No way. He's alive. He's sinking to the bottom wearing his armor. Armor doesn't float. But I don't think that Jaime is dead. There's a great article on Den of Geek, and I'll put it in our show notes. I found it this weekend, where they have their death predictor. It's like a Game of Thrones Deadpool, but they actually predict all of the characters who will live or not survive in this season. And it's really fun to read, and they have really good reasons for all of their choices. Oh, wow. I believe they predict that Jaime will live. So I'm going to go with Den of Geek. I think there's too many interesting things to happen with Jaime still alive. So I'm going to say Jaime's still alive.
I think, I don't know, it was such a dramatic end. I feel like he might be dead. And that is going to spin Cersei into an extreme rage, which will turn this battle and Game for Thrones up 100 notches.
But I think if he were dead, he would have been burned by the dragon, or his head would have been bitten off by the dragon. I think, you know, seeing his body floating away, but, you know, and the fact that somebody jumped in and saved him, so there's a person down there with him, I think he's alive.
Who do you think saved him?
I think it's that sellsword. What's his name? The sellsword?
I don't know his name either.
Okay. Right, because too many characters, but it's that guy.
Let me phone my cousin. Hold on.
I know, really. It's that guy or that young knight.
That young strapping, I think his name was Dickon.
Oh, yeah. That's funny. Exactly.
Well, he's pretty nice to look at, so hopefully he saved him.
All right. I don't know. He didn't do it for me. A little dumb in the face.
Wow!
There wasn't a lot of intelligence ringing forth from his visage. But, yeah, I liked that battle, of course. And maybe this is a conversation for another podcast. We can talk about who we want to be on the Iron Throne. I don't know if I'm rooting for Daenerys. I think she is crazy. I think she's got a little bit of her dad's madness. And I think what happens is she's crazy and it starts bubbling up. And then fortunately someone's there to kind of calm her down. And I don't want her on the Iron Throne. But then sometimes I do. Let's talk about this in another episode. All right, shall we move on to another show, which we love for so many different reasons,
Yes.
Okay, let's talk about Queen Sugar, and specifically its second season, and even more specifically, the mid-season finale, which just occurred last week. So, the series premiered last year on OWN, and it succeeded in a big way with fans and critics. The show is artful and moving, and it brought prestige television into Oprah's life. So, I love to talk about second seasons, and how second seasons are actually more difficult in many ways than first seasons. So, Amita, let's talk about the second season of Queen Sugar, and particularly whether it succeeded or how it succeeded in some of the challenges that are inherent in second seasons. So, for example, I think characters have to grow. There has to be a lot of character growth. It can't be the same character from season one, but they still have to be familiar, right? They still have to be the character you connected with. So, So Amita, in your opinion, looking at the second season of Queen Sugar from when the characters started out in episode one to this mid-season finale, do you think the show succeeded in showing character growth?
Yeah, I do, for sure. I think specifically Charlie and Nova, they're much more clearer path of growth, and sometimes the growth I think that they show is being broken down and kind of dealing much more deeply with some of their past and some of their actions and the consequences of them. And I think Charlie, I feel so connected to her in so many ways sometimes, and she had such an incredible story this season, just in many directions, but I just really love her character, and I think that she definitely showed some growth. And Nova, I think, was a little bit like just more minimally shown, I think, in her storyline, but there were still moments of it, and those moments showed her being uncomfortable, I think, in some ways, and going outside of her comfort zone and learning more about herself within that process, which I thought was really great.
I really haven't felt characters this complex and nuanced. I'm going to say I hold 6 feet under as the gold standard, but I really haven't seen nuanced characters like this in 6 feet under, in my opinion. I think for Nova, to me, and it dawned on me this season that Nova is all about her public life and her private self. And I think we all are, but that character really does, you know, there's public Nova who is super woke and fighting for justice and for social justice and an activist journalist and beautiful dreads and Afrocentric, right? Privately, she is a woman who had fallen in love with a white cop, and privately is a woman who had dealt with that breakup by having a series of anonymous sexual encounters with white men who look like that white cop. And not as privately, because I think she's openly bisexual to all of her friends, but, you know, had relations with women. But then also is hurt and always felt not fully loved by her father. And then you wonder, is that kind of that immense striving for success one way to earn her father's love still? You know, I think that character is so fascinating. I think Charlie, for me, was initially maybe a little warning light at the beginning of season one. I'm like, oh, is this the character that we're not supposed to like? And I've seen this character before, the kind of uptight, light-skinned, wealthy woman. And all credit to Queen Sugar for Charlie not being that at all. Again, every episode we see layers and layers peeled off, and oh my gosh, one of my favorite moments, I love talking about moments, in the second to last episode, she's sitting at the table with Aunt Vi, and Aunt Vi,
that's mine too,
and she just says to her, it always seemed to be about Ralph Angel, and Aunt Vi says, her younger brother Ralph Angel, and Aunt Vi says, he needed the help. He needs someone to fight for him. And Charlie just is like, she's just so exhausted. And she said, but I need someone to fight for me too. And I actually watched this episode with my sister on the couch, and both of us were in tears.
We're like, oh, I was no. in tears. Just you saying it again makes me well up because, yeah, that's one of the moments where I connected with her so much.
Yeah.
And her point was that she's like, everybody's fighting for Ralph Angel, but he did that. Like, he chose to commit a crime and go to jail. Like, he did that to himself. What did she do? There's nothing she feels like she did
right.
to have... you know, to deal with her husband cheating and, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And her son going through something mysteriously wrong with the cops that she doesn't know about. Like, what did she do? Right.
Yeah.
And why doesn't she have somebody fighting for her and supporting her? And I just, that was such a good scene.
All right. So let's talk about the second thing I think that that's needed to succeed in a second season. Storylines. I think the storylines need to be compelling. I think they need to not be too repetitive from season one, but they can't be kind of too over the top. You can't have everyone in outer space all of a sudden. So in terms of the storylines of season two, and I guess we should say there might be a few spoilers in this conversation,
mm-hmm.
but if you haven't seen Queen Sugar, we hope this conversation piques your interest, and so we'll try not to spoil too much. And listen, even if you go in knowing some stuff, it's still so emotionally and intellectually satisfying. So take heed.
Please watch it.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, Amita, what do you think? In terms of storylines, are there any storylines in season two that you think really succeed at moving things forward, but still kind of feeling familiar and authentic to what they did in season one?
Yeah, and then to go back to Charlie again, I think that's one of the storylines that does move things forward. She spent the first season trying to manage and figure out how to kind of resurrect the sugarcane farm, but then towards the end of the season, she saw a need for a mill, and then this season she's created that mill, and you know that it was a lot of work for her, and it seems to be that there is some early success with it, and we'll see where it goes. So I think that was really, really important for her storyline, because it gave her something else to focus on as a businesswoman, which before it was mostly focusing on her husband's business, you know. And there's this moment where she's sitting with all of the sugarcane farmers, and they all don't believe her motives to help them. They think that she's in it for herself as a business, and she might leave. And she says, she's very, very eloquently discusses and makes her case and convinces them all that this is not just a business, you know, prospect for me. I'm in this. I want to do right by my father and his wishes, and I want to help this community. And I think that was huge for her.
Yeah, I felt like if season one was the story of all of the Bordelones, but Nova seemed at the center in so many ways, it feels like season two belongs to Charlie.
She went through so much this season, and after a really emotional day, she wakes up. She has her hair natural. She's not all buttoned up. She's not all in the fancy designer threads. And she's kind of a little more stripped down. And that was their way of showing her kind of also evolving in a different way.
Don't touch my hair. Okay. My final thought about what makes a successful second season. The next season, do you as a viewer have a compelling need to watch season 2.5 coming this fall and beyond? Do you feel like Queen Sugar in its second season has set up potential for compelling, amazing, surprising storylines?
Yeah, definitely. You know, to recap a little bit of the last episode of the mid-season finale, you know, Aunt Vi is wearing herself down. She fainted, you know, there's a hint that maybe there's something else there, but hopefully it's just that she's stressed and she's, you know, taking on the burden of her nephew and nieces not getting along. There's some of that. I think, you know, spoilers again, Ralph Angel proposes to Darla. So we'll see what happens there.
More tears from Sean David Johnson. That was one of the most beautiful television proposals in the history of TV.
It was.
And they both seem so fragile in so many ways, emotionally fragile. Their relationship seems fragile. It's strengthening, but yeah, you really care. It feels like it's like a little eggshell, their relationship. And
it is,
you
want
to
yeah.
continue watching. And my hope would be that Darla, for as long as the show is on, I would really hate to see Darla relapse. I mean, I know it happens. It's real life. And that might be a storyline that they decide to pursue. But I also think that there are success stories in... There are so many success stories with people who battle addiction. And I would love for them to just depict her success story season after season. Never easy. Always a struggle. But... I would just love for this character to show that it is possible to overcome drug and alcohol dependency. So,
yeah, I think they did a great job of that in the finale, too, by having, you know, Ralph Angel and Charlie go to her 2-year sober ceremony and stuff. So, you know, they are trying to show her being active and really... working hard at her recovery, which I think that's really important to show.
So many great things about this show. I cannot wait for the second half of season 2 to begin. And
yeah, I think it's coming sooner than I expected for a mid-season return, because usually they wait a few months, but I think we might get it in like September, October. So we're not waiting that long, which is great.
I'm demanding it.
Yes, please. I cannot wait.
Ava, you know you're not doing that much. Quite the opposite.
Please.
I'm sure she's editing A Wrinkle in Time right now, which is due in March.
Yes.
She's also working on a 5-part, I guess we'll call it a mini-series for Netflix on the Central Park Five. She's also the executive producer of Queen Sugar, and she probably has some other projects we don't even know about yet. So I bow down to, I've tweeted at her a few times, I think from my account and from our account, but just thanking her for bringing such rich, beautiful, intelligent, and emotional works to the screen. I'm really seriously grateful for her and the work she creates.
Me too. I'm the number one fangirl of her and especially, you know, her crusade, for lack of a better term, to make sure that female creators, directors, writers, producers are represented in all of her works, which is really amazing.
Yeah, all the episodes in season 2 have been directed by women, which is great.
Yes.
Great. All right, so coming up after this short message, we are going to discuss the controversy surrounding the film Detroit and also share some of the feedback we got from some of our listeners about our discussion on South Asian romantic depictions in pop culture. That's all coming up after this short message.
I'm Riley Smurl.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And I'm Taylor Smurl.
And together, we host a podcast called Still Buffering, where we answer questions like...
Why should I not fall asleep first at a slumber party?
How do I be fleek? Is it okay to break up with someone using emojis?
And sometimes we talk about bugs.
No, we don't. Nope.
Find out the answers to these important questions and many more on Still Buffering, a sister's guide to teens through the ages.
I am a teenager.
And... I was too. Butts, 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 butts.
No. Will you change your mind? For too many times.
Over and over again. Over and over again. Welcome back to Inside Pop. I'm Sean David Johnson.
And I'm Amita Patel. Last week, we had an interesting discussion about South Asian interracial relationships on TV and film, which came from a recent article that I read. And it was entitled, The Pursuit of White Women, Brown Actors Like Aziz Ansari Have Reduced Brown Women to a Punchline. Needless to say, we heard from a few listeners immediately about that conversation. And one, first of all, thanks for the feedback. I think that was really great to hear kind of some people really reacting and having an opinion about our conversation. That's what I love about this podcast too. And so I think I read one listener who understood the point of view that I had had, which was that the examples discussed in the article, Master of None, The Big Sick, Meet the Patels, and Homecoming King, all four of them come from real life experiences. They've all done interviews about it. They've all said that these things happened in their real lives, and therefore they happen to be attracted to and fall in love with white women. And that's fine. Right. And I said, if it came from their real experiences, why would they have to force a South Asian female lead in there? If that is where their creative kind of direction was coming from, depicting their lives. So, yeah, I don't think that in those particular cases that a South Asian lead female was purposely diminished. So this listener responded and said, the way that South Asian women are presented is a stereotype. It would be nice to see South Asian women presented by these men in a better light. Which is a very, very interesting and smart comment about this discussion, which I don't think we really got to discuss.
Right, right. We spent a lot of time talking about the interracial relationships. Yeah, we didn't really talk about what happens when they are on screen. Yeah, I mean, I would say that, listen, I think I'm feeling a little bit stronger about it than I did last week. Last week I said it comes down to personal expression or social responsibility. And I'm going to say, I'm going to be a little bit stronger, and I'm going to say that if you have a series, let's just say you have a series, you're South Asian, and you have happened to date a lot of white women, but you've done episodes on how tough it is to be a South Asian actor, you do have a responsibility, despite whatever your personal attractions and experiences are, you have a responsibility to cast Indian women. You have a responsibility. Mm-hmm. You can't just, this isn't a journal, right? It's like you have much more responsibility. This isn't your diary. You're employing people. You're telling stories that affect people. So, talking about Master of None, two seasons in a row, two white love interests who, you know, were employed actresses who were able to make money off of this and, you know, continue their careers. Zero for young Asian women.
They did, you know, I still think that he comes from an honest place, and he did have that episode about first dates where he did go on a couple of dates with two different South Asian females. And I think he did spend a little more time about the development of those dates than with some of the other dates he was on.
Yeah, I love that episode.
Yeah, you know, the girl who has the ramen blog. Like, that was hilarious, you know? Okay. And then the other girl he went on a date with, super cute. I can't remember her name, but she's awesome, and she's been in a few things. And it seemed like they were starting to get along. And then after, I think, the second date maybe, or first date, she bumps into somebody, I think, that might have been her ex on the street, who happened to be white.
Right. But he wrote that. You know, didn't actually happen. It's not so, but he decided to write that and then write the Italian woman back in the United States. You know, he had the power, and I don't want to like start attacking Aziz Ansari, but it's just a fact. Aziz Ansari and Alan Yang had the power to make that woman the love interest to continue throughout the rest of the season, but he decided not to.
Yes. Right. We won't know why he decided not to.
Right. Until we interview him on this podcast.
Exactly. Unless that is what actually happened in his real life, which a lot of this is derived from, or if there's another reason, which we don't know. So I think that was an interesting, to further that, she said it was a stereotype. So I think that particular comment doesn't apply to the girls that were in Master of None. Mm-hmm. I think it applies to some of the girls that they portrayed in The Big Sick, because they portrayed a whole storyline about his parents trying to arrange his marriage. And there were a number of Pakistani, young women coming to the house for dinner. And there were some stereotypes there. There was one who had an accent and who seemed to be very dutiful and trying hard to connect with him because he's a big X-Files fan. So she tried to binge watch or just be very familiar with X-Files, you know, to make a good impression on him. And yes, those stereotypes, not ideal. You know, maybe we didn't have to go that far in showing, you know, a potential love interest or marriage candidate in those scenes. So I get that. I completely get that.
Well, we had another comment from Esta Fiesta, who is a fellow podcaster. She hosts the Poised and Polished podcast. And she tweeted after listening to our episode, and she said, quote, I think that the weirdness is that they all emphasize the white love interest. Of the five mentioned, not one emphasized a South Asian love. I get that this is based on their real lives, but don't you find that interesting too? Yeah. And so what I got from Esta Fiesta's tweet is, yep, they're writing about their own lives and fictionalizing in some ways their own lives, but what, you know, kind of bringing up the question, so what does it mean or what does it say that all of these people we're talking about are interested in dating outside of their race? And we touched a little bit on this last week, but, you know, and I tweeted back and I just said, yeah, like, you know, is the fact that Aziz Ansari, Mindy Kaling, Hasan Minhaj, who I know is married to an Asian woman now, but dated white women, you know, are all these, is it the fact that they're in a creative field? Are they more likely to date outside of their race? You know, it, like, I don't know what the statistics are, but I think Esther brings up a good point of,
yeah,
you know, there's what they depict in their work, and then there's their real lives, and let's think about how their real lives affect their work.
Yeah, definitely. And it goes back to this is what they're living for the most part that we know. And I think, but you know, she brings up a good point, you know, like they can still emphasize one, you know, like maybe for, you know, Aziz could have had maybe some significant luck with one South Asian woman in one of the episodes. He could have. They didn't really do it as much. You know, it really was self-contained in that one episode, right? So it is interesting. It is. And it's going to be interesting to see another potential new show come out that might hopefully feature two South Asian leads. We'll see. And see what kind of feedback that gets and what kind of reaction it gets and see if it becomes as popular as all these.
Yes, definitely. And I really appreciate listeners emailing, tweeting, and listen, if you ever have any opinions, we'd be happy to read them on the show and include them in the discussion. So, of course, you can tweet us at Pop Insiders. You can email us at insidepoppodcast@gmail.com. And you can always go on to insidepoppodcast.com. That's our official website, and one is able to leave comments. So yeah, please reach out to us and let us know what you're thinking about any of this stuff. I love when people agree, of course, but I also love when people disagree or just have different opinions that I've never really thought about before. So
same here.
Yeah, I imagine we have a pretty diverse listenership. So I love that diversity of opinion to come through and make this a two-way conversation.
Yes. And if you guys have any more comments about this conversation or anything else we heard, please tweet us at Pop Insiders.
Right on. Now let's move on to talk about the movie Detroit. The film opened wide last weekend and disappointed at the box office. But I think much more interesting than that, the film has really, really elicited extreme reactions. People hate it. People really like it. People have called it racist. People have called it muddled filmmaking. People have called it inspired filmmaking. It has really, 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 more than any film I can remember in a long time, garnered intense different reactions. So Amita and I want to talk a little bit about our reaction of seeing the film and the reactions of the people who were seeing the film with us, there were boos. Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert, there were boos. Someone booed. Yes. It was like the Cannes Film Festival. So, Amita, we saw it together at a Producers Guild screening, correct?
We did.
Okay. When we walked out of the movie, it's every once in a while I'll see a movie and I don't want to speak to people after the movie. I'm one who doesn't need to like immediately say I liked it, I loved it, it was good, it was bad. I like to process for a while.
Right.
Quick tangent. When I saw Moonlight, for example, last year, I stayed for the Q&A. I immediately left. I didn't want to speak to anyone. I didn't want to hear anyone else's opinions. I wanted to be alone because it just was such a beautiful, precious film to me. I didn't need to hear anybody else. I just wanted to be alone for a while with myself and my own thoughts about the film. Detroit was different. I just felt assaulted by the film. It was just exhausting and painful for me to watch. And again, I didn't need to be around anyone. But you were. So what was that experience like?
I came out of the theater and I just saw a couple familiar faces, one of which was very, very angry and frustrated after the film. And I was just taken aback because I just left the theater. And so just to your point, like, I haven't felt this way after a film in a while, but I also needed time, like you said, to process and figure out how I felt about everything. And I didn't get that because I got this friend's reaction and I was like, okay, I don't know what I feel now. Now I'm feeling what she's pointing out and somebody else was pointing out. And then I kind of latched onto those feelings because they made very good points. And then I was just like, what's going on? And then there was just like a lot of anger. So then I kind of walked away and I saw you. And I was like, let me go talk to Sean. Come next to me.
And you brought them over.
I did not purposely bring them over. Fine. I just said, let me go talk to Sean. But they happened to know you as well. And they came as well.
So listen. So one person said very, like lots of vitriol, very dramatically, you know, this movie is irresponsible. This movie just makes me want to go out and kill white police officers. So what good is that? Yeah. A little dramatic, but listen, that's what that person felt. So I would not deny them that experience, that those feelings. So that's an intense reaction. You know, I think there are also a lot of reviews, online blogs, actual newspaper, magazine reviews. And I think what's interesting, so a lot of interesting points have been raised. One thing that people have pointed out blank said is, well, this is what happens when you let white filmmakers make a movie about this type of black experience. And let's just say for people who haven't seen trailers or reviews, the film is about the 1967 Detroit uprisings, also called the Detroit riots, and about a particular event that took place in the Algiers Motel where a couple of police officers interrogate and torture and humiliate and eventually murder some people who they suspect of shooting at them. And the scene, the second act, is that interrogation. It's unrelenting. It's torturous. It feels sadistic. And I think the thing that everyone wrestles with is, what is the point of this? And I think some people may have seen the film and said, oh, the point is showing that this type of police brutality existed, still exists. And the filmmakers wanted to take you there, put you there to show you the horror, to make you angry, to awaken you to the fact that this stuff has happened and probably still does happen. But I think the other reaction was people seeing that, like, I know that exists. You almost seem to revel in how barbaric this experience was, and I didn't really get anything beyond that from those scenes. So I think those are the two extreme reactions, I think, which is causing really such a huge, huge divide.
Yeah. Once I was able to have some alone time to gather my own thoughts, I felt similarly. Like, why were we, for lack of a better term, forced to sit through very harrowing, drawn out scenes where these officers were torturing and taunting and beating these black young people in this hotel? Why?
What do you think Catherine Bigelow would say to that?
I think she's trying to tell the story and trying to be as real as what she had read and, you know, researched about and be accurate to the story. I just feel like it was such a long part of the film that became difficult to watch it. They're just very, very long portion of this film was very, very difficult to watch. And I don't know, I think maybe she wanted to maybe have you become uncomfortable by it to really maybe feel that this was so terrible, horrible, and that you may get a sense of what these young men and women went through.
You know, I think Catherine Bigelow is one of my favorite filmmakers, despite Detroit. I think Hurt Locker is one of my top three films of the 21st century. Hyperbole. Mm-hmm. It's true. And I think Zero Dark Thirty is masterful. And
agreed.
Point Break is on point. Says Sean Johnson of Inside Pop. Love Point Break. So I think she's great. And she's a great filmmaker. But the one question I kept turning in my head is, how would a black filmmaker of equal stature, equal talent, how would they have made the film? Because I do think, because my short answer is yes, she had the right to make this film. I would not deny a white director a chance to make a film about a black experience. I would not deny a gay actor a chance to play a straight role. I would not deny an Asian woman a chance to play Watson on a CBS procedural. I just would not do mm-hmm. that. But I do. So for me, the more interesting question is, how would a black filmmaker have done this film differently? How would Ava DuVernay have made, if she had decided to make Detroit, and maybe part of it is, maybe this is a story that wouldn't have been told, how would Spike Lee have made Detroit differently?
Mm-hmm.
And you know what my answer is? I think that all of these, you know, Steve McQueen, the director of 12 Years a Slave, what would he have done? He doesn't shy away from brutality. He did not show away from showing black bodies under assault in 12 Years a Slave. But yes. I think that, I guess I should give some answer since I raised that question. I think one answer is I think that, and another colleague of ours kind of said this, he used the word agency. And I think I think many directors would not have wanted to spend so much time showing that assault. And I think you would have been taken away from there. I think maybe it would have been flashbacks, or I think maybe it would have been a shorter section. I think you would have seen more of the aftermath of actually what they did to fight this, what they did to get justice. And listen, every director would have handled this differently, but I think it's a valid question.
I think so too. I completely, think it's everyone would do it differently, and you won't know what their interpretation of the story was. You know, I think Ava DuVernay did her depiction of Selma much differently and much more powerfully, in my opinion. It was a different event, though. So, this was a difficult historical moment to try to depict, and I'm not sure if the way that they told the story could have elevated in a different way for my reaction to it.
Yeah, and when it comes down to it, I think that she's a great filmmaker, but this is not a great film. I just don't think it succeeds. And I've actually been asked by a couple people whether they should see it, and I've said no. I said I think it's in the same way that I told people not to see Birth of a Nation. Don't attack me if you want to, but I said that the pain of seeing that film, the film is not worth the pain that it inflicts. The Birth of a Nation is not a great film, nor is Detroit. Black filmmaker making the Nat Turner story, white filmmaker making a story about the Detroit uprisings. So it's not just about race or gender, but about the filmmaker's skills mm-hmm. and ability to tell a specific story. So, yeah, I'm not recommending it. Don't go see it.
Yeah, somebody had asked me that too, and I said, I really don't know how to tell you to watch it or not watch it without influencing your reaction to it. You know, I think the one thing I said, one word I said was, it's difficult. That's all I could tell you, you know? And that word is laced with many different meanings.
mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I'm feeling comfortable telling people, no, don't go see it. You know, I like telling people what to do. Okay.
Yes. Yes, you do. So, you know, I think we've already given our kind of background and feelings about this film. Sean says, don't see it. I say, make your own decision. I don't recommend it, but you know, if you feel like you want to know what we're talking about, then by all means, watch it. all right. Well, we'll have the big sell right after this short message.
What's the deal with Brexit? Have you seen Happy Valley yet?
How do British people pronounce Edinburgh, Leicester, or Norwich?
Not like that.
Are you tired of getting your world news from reliable sources, often with no puns or sexual innuendo?
Why was there a butcher's hat haunting Coronation Street?
What's Coronation Street, and why is Dave Holmes obsessed with it?
International Waters pairs a team of comedians in LA against a team of comedians in London in a pop culture battle royale. Join us once a fortnight to hear the best comedians in the world trade jokes and stories and maybe even learn something at the same time. International Waters with me, Dave Holmes. Find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside Pop. I'm Amita Patel.
And I'm Sean David Johnson. And now it's time for our favorite segment, The Big Sell. This is the segment, of course, where Amita and I each take a turn recommending something from the world of pop culture we love and want the other one to love as well. Last week, Amita big sold me a group called The Suffers and their self-titled album called The Suffers. I listened, I learned, I'm here to tell the story. I enjoyed The Suffers a lot. I'm going to shout a little callback to Master of None. There is that great episode in season one where it's There Can Only Be One, where he's talking about Indian actors and auditioning, and oh, there can only be one. And so when I first started listening to The Suffers, I thought, oh, but I've got Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. I don't need more of this because the sound is so and beautifully Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, that kind of funk, soul, upbeat music. And I got to the third track. And I was like, oh, you know what? I've got room. I've got room for The Suffers as well. I really enjoyed it a lot. And I did a little research. I don't think they're signed to any label yet. I think they're an independent group making their own way. I think they tour mm-hmm. a lot to make some cash. And they're really enjoyable. The Suffers. Thank you, Amita.
You're welcome. Definitely check out The Suffers. Suffers, I hope you get a little bit of a boost from us talking about you guys on this podcast. And I hope to hear some more music from you guys in the future. I would definitely try to go see them if they came around New York. I think they'd be a really fun band to watch live. There's one song on this album that I thought was really interesting and like diverted a little from their sound called Giver, which is extremely intimate. And I really enjoyed their kind of, they're very sexy song on this album with a lot of soul. And, you know, there's some country in here. There's some classic rock in here. I just really felt so many different vibes. So I'm really glad you liked it.
Yeah.
I cannot wait to hear your rating.
I would like to give The Suffers 3 stars. That's my Ed McMahon impression. 3 stars for The Suffers.
Lovely. Good. Okay. What do you have to sell to me this week?
I would like to sell you some music as well this week. As you know, I'm super hyped to attend Afropunk 2017. It's an amazing 2-day music festival that happens in Brooklyn, but also London and South Africa and maybe another place in the world as well.
Atlanta, I think Atlanta,
yes. And so it's this great 2-day festival, amazing musicians, everyone there kind of embraces the idea of Afropunk through their wardrobe in a myriad of ways. Everyone there is stylish and fun, and the credo is no racism, no ageism, no fatism, no homophobia. It's just a day of good black music and spirit. And so I'm getting excited for this festival, which happens in about 3 weeks. And I found someone whose name is Z Nicole. I don't know her, but she created an Afropunk 2017 playlist. And it's filled with a bunch of people I don't know, but that I'm really getting into. So this is a case, Amita, where you should hit shuffle and listen.
I can hit shuffle.
Because what Z's done is, I think she's just selected a bunch of artists, and she's, you know, given you a selections from their albums or an EP. Or so I think it's fine to hit shuffle and just let all these great new artists enter into your life, into your earbuds. So everyone from SZA, Anderson .Paak, those are names recognize. Sam Du is on there.
Leaky
Lee, Kevin Abstract, Little Slims. So a bunch of, and the Cool Kids. So some names I knew, but I don't know the music.
Right.
Some people I've never heard of before, some people I know and like. So it's just, I think, a really great selection of great musicians. And I usually don't listen to playlists made by people I don't know, but Z Nicole, I thank you. I love your playlist, and I would love to big sell that to you, Amita.
I love it. I love it all. I love it so much. I cannot wait. I like a good playlist. So yeah, I can't wait to check this out.
I hope you enjoy it.
All right, well, that's it for this week. Stay in touch with us on Twitter and Instagram at Pop Insiders, and head over to InsidePopPodcast.com to find out more about us. And, of course, subscribe to this lovely podcast.
Also, you can find us on MaximumFun.org alongside a group of great podcasts, all of whom are dedicated to comedy and or culture like us.
All right, well, have a great week, y'all.
Take care. Bye.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.